You're storing memories to lose them again. You'll forget everything when this whole thing ends. You can't even predict what tomorrow brings. But don't lose track of living in the present.
Welcome to the Memory Distillery, everyone. I'm Anthony Verneri.
And I'm John Deck, and each week we will malt, mash, ferment, and distill our way through the spirits of our past in the form of long-loved movies.
And this week, the first rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. That's right, we're watching Fight Club from 1999, directed by David Fincher. John, you suggested this, didn't you, a couple weeks ago?
I did. I think you and I have chatted about doing this for a while. Like, I know it's been on our lists because we've had some pretty big, ambitious lists over the last year or two. And but we haven't really gotten into it. And then my friend Tad, who I've mentioned once or twice before, mostly because he's famous for saying he doesn't like The Princess Bride because Fred Savage's head is too big. that's his claim to fame. Oh, and he also got me hooked on Joe versus the Volcano. But we were just chatting, and he was asking me about Fight Club as one that if we've considered doing for the podcast. And he actually also asked me a really interesting question about the movie that I'll save for later when we get into more conversation after we watch it. But yeah, so I think this could be a great movie. I mean, it's one that I really enjoyed a lot for a number of different reasons, both for the David Fincher's style of directing, the stylistic way what went on in the movie, and also, I mean, I haven't watched it in a long time, but there were just certain elements that really spoke to me throughout the movie that I just don't know, with me being the version of who I am right now, is it going to speak to me in the same way? What am I going to get out of it? You know, it'll be very interesting.
Well, because I'm glad that you brought up that part, because like this, when it first came out and for, you know, the ensuing years after, like it was really popular in a lot of different groups for different reasons. Like, it's anti-establishment, and, you know, it's got these anarchist elements and anti-capitalism and pro-equality and all this other stuff that a lot of different groups really sort of glommed onto, and maybe some other less savory groups glommed onto some portions of it as well. But like the a lot of the movie for me still sticks in my head. Like, I can't imagine that there's going to be a scene that I run across that I go, oh, I forgot about this scene, or, you know, I don't remember the lines from this scene or whatever. Like, I've watched this movie probably 25 times since it came out, and like a lot of it sticks with me, like the narration and Marla and her sort of a crazy character, and even like Meatloaf, John, you know,
Bob,
Robert Paulson, Bob, Bob has bitch tits. Like he sticks with me, and like I mean, I like lots of different works by Chuck Palahniuk, but this one I think might be one of my favorites, both as a book and as a movie.
Yeah, it's. I think there's a lot to like, a lot to observe with it, but yeah, like I said, I think it. I believe I'm gonna have a better time just accepting it for what it is, rather than, like you said, the different groups of people in different ways took it as various levels of manifestos. And I mean, I wouldn't say I was necessarily on any of those levels per se, but I definitely had certain little mini life lessons that stuck out and still stick with me more than other things. But at its core, I mean, I just love a good movie with good storytelling. And if you have, and by the way, if the last 20 years you haven't had a chance to watch this movie yet, we're probably going to get into a little bit of spoilers, as we tend to do. but I'll just say that the movie, you know, the fact that it has a twist to it, like, one of my least favorite things are movies that just telegraph a twist coming. Yeah, I'm looking at you, M. Night Shyamalan. and that really is just a fault of what happened after Sixth Sense. Not that he is. Anyway, we could get into reasons why M. Night Shyamalan is not a wonderful.
We'll get into that when we do an M. Night Shyamalan
film. Yeah, that's a different story. But my point is that to have a movie that says something or many things in a very interesting, creative, artistic way, and just also happens to have like really solid acting and a great twist that, you know, leaves you wondering, did I miss the, am I the stupid one? Like, you know, was this a trick? Is this not a really, but when you go back and follow all the pieces, everything lines up and it makes perfect sense. It's like, that's just a treat to get to go through that. And so, yeah, I'm pretty looking forward to this. Is that even a good phrase? I don't know.
It's a you phrase, and that's what we're going to go with. Yeah, I think especially from an acting perspective, like I think that especially with our last outing with Ed Norton, like I think that we're going to be in for a treat. We're not going to have to deal with Rounders Ed Norton. It's going to be, you know, a much more enjoyable experience. But I think that what I'm most concerned with is, will Fight Club stand the test of time, or are we going to find that it's dated and it misses the mark? Yeah. But I think that the only way for us to find that out is for us to go and watch it. What do you say, John?
I would tend to agree with you on this point.
Okay, great. So we're going to go and do that. It's streaming on HBO Go and HBO Max and HBO Now, whatever other 13 HBO streaming services there are today. If you don't have it on any of those, get it from your personal library or rent it from one of the various online streaming services that there are. And when we come back, we are breaking the first rule of Fight Club.
And when we get back, we are breaking the second rule of Fight Club.
Let's do it.
All right.
I am Jack's return to the show. How are we doing, everyone? We just got done watching Fight Club. John, one of the tough parts of watching this movie for me, or I guess one of the tough parts of this job, is we try to go into these movies, or I try to go into these movies at least, with sort of a fresh outlook and a fresh take. And on some movies, it's easier to do than others. And on this movie, I think it's particularly difficult because there's so many bits and pieces to this movie and so much like foreshadowing and stuff that happens that, you know, you get big reveals toward the end of the movie. And so going into this movie, having already watched it, you already know all of those things. And so a very small part of me feels like it takes away from the experience.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see that there's certain elements of the movie when you know they're coming, it's not quite the revelation it is when you're, you know, watching for the first time or rewatching it to try to catch little things you missed before. And once you've seen it enough times, that aspect of it might fall a little bit flat, just in terms, not making the movie any worse, it just means your own experience is just, it's hard for an unpredictable movie like this to be predictable because you've experienced it. Fortunately, I didn't have that problem this time around.
Oh?
No, I fixated differently on this movie than I ever have, and I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Okay, well, let's talk some about that.
For different reasons.
So what did you fixate on with this movie?
So you have this movie called Fight Club. Have I lost you yet?
Yeah, I've... I'm going to need you to back up and slow it down.
So there are many aspects to this movie that we've probably individually just chewed on ourselves many times, trying to unpack a lot of the psychological information that's going on amongst Tyler Durden and himself. All those different levels. And then you have all the aspects of anarchy and just so many different things that are right out there and lots of stuff to chew on. But this time, this is how I saw Fight Club. It's just a darker, grittier Wes Anderson movie. It is a dysfunctional romantic comedy between the narrator and Helena. Marla. That forget all that other stuff with Tyler and terrorism and anarchy and all that other stuff. No, this is just a romantic comedy with Edward Norton and Helena Bonham Carter in it.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, I can By the way, everyone, I know we said it up top, but spoilers from here on out. Like, if you haven't seen Fight Club, what the fuck are you doing? Go watch Fight Club and then come back and listen to the show. But yeah, seriously, like, spoilers. Yeah, so it's really cool, I think, how David Fincher put this dynamic together, because you have these scenes where our narrator is like listening to, especially the kitchen scenes, he's listening to Marla and Tyler have sex, and so he's outside of that moment and he's not a part of it, and then Marla comes into the kitchen and they're having these real shitty interactions with each other, like completely devoid of the emotion that you would probably have with somebody with whom you're sleeping. So to not only have that as people, but to be able to convey that as actors, I think was really, really, it really speaks to the credit of how the movie was cast and how it was directed and how you had that sort of chemistry between Helena Bonham Carter and Ed Norton, like just being able to interact in the way that they do, I thought was really, really brilliantly done.
Yeah, and in some ways, like, this is almost like a version of a twisted just coming of age story, because you have Edward Norton, who I'm calling that because he doesn't really have a name in the movie.
Well, in Project Mayhem, we have no names.
Exactly. And he didn't die, so he wasn't assigned a name. Anyway, yeah, like you're introduced to him, and he's at an age where he's kind of already slipped into that corporate trap, you know, the working at office job he hates, and, you know, furnishing and buying things for his house, because that's kind of how he's measured or thinks that's what success is or can be. And like, he's just kind of emotionally stunted, not available to anyone or anything, let alone real human interactions with real relationships. And so he goes to these groups, and he gets the briefest glimpse and the briefest release of emotions. And like, he instantly, you know, becomes addicted to that. But like, that is like the safe realm somewhere between having like no human connections, interactions, and having some that are kind of real, but they're ultimately, emotions may be real, but, you know, the situationally, nothing about it is actually, you know, real and truthful and honest with the people that he's, you know, connecting with in terms of anything he may be suffering or ailing from. He has his own problems that aren't, you know, various cancers or bloodborne illnesses or anything like that. But yeah, like, so he's just, he's childish and immature and just doesn't know how to, you know, connect to another human being in a meaningful way. And so when Marla shows up at these meetings, he acts just like a kid, you know, when you're like, are trying to, you like are stuck between flirting and thinking girls are gross. And so he's just like, I hate her. She made everything bad. Like, it's just
he's the kid on the playground who runs up and hits the girl and then runs away.
And so like, to just have that reaction, I mean, I was more mesmerized by Marla as a character than anyone else in the movie this time around. And every time she showed up, and this was the one advantage to not watching it for the first time and having seen it, you know, many times, is that I could just dig in and watch everything that she did, knowing the context of the entire story and what was happening and what that means. So every reaction she has to, you know, to Edward Norton's character, whether it's she's walking into a room after she was just having passionate sex with him for 4 hours, you know, we, you know, like, having watched the movie, we know that's exactly what happened. And now wandering into the room where he must have just come in himself before her, and like, he's just like, what are you doing here? Ew. And she's like, what the fuck? You know, like, like, it's just that like dynamic of, is this just a dysfunctional relationship with a guy who is a jerk, or, you know, what's really going on here? And there's, you know, countless stories of of relationships that go like that, where, you know, they have, you know, there could be great chemistry, great sex, great interactions, but then tons of fighting, no real seeing of each other for who they are. Like, there's just so many layers like that. And so, yeah, like everything that she did, I was just like, I'm just like, I just want to stand up and clap, because I'm like, yeah, that was awesome. Like, it's so good. So yeah, that's why I had no problem, and I never even kind of faded in terms of interest, except the times when she was off the scenes for too long.
Well, and I'm so glad you described Ed Norton's character that way, because I'd want to almost go back and try to sort of parse. I'd like to sort of almost go back and try to parse this out, but I wonder how many of the guys in Fight Club are only children, because I'm pretty sure at some point both the narrator and Tyler allude to them being only children and coming from homes, like coming from like the products of divorce, and their dad's running off and doing other stuff. And we grew up in a time when that was sort of really becoming commonplace, like families splitting up and divorce becoming a thing. And you know, not everyone was still bought into the whole idea of the nuclear family. So, like, you ended up with only children who were in broken homes and didn't have the emotional or the emotional support or the encouragement or whatever to go out and socialize and be a strong and independent person. And so you end up with a character like our narrator who doesn't know how to function as an independent person amongst other independent people. So he doesn't know how to make friends. He doesn't know how to have interpersonal relationships. And so his only outlet is to lash out at Marla or to start a fight club. Like, it's his only outlet is to hit. And to, whether it's physically or verbally, hit. And like your first time watching this, I think you sort of feel like you can relate to some of the things that go on with the narrator. And then I think later on, maybe you start to kind of see him as a little bit of an unwilling villain, simply because of like he's a product of his upbringing. Man, I went off on a tangent there about, I don't know where I got lost, but I'm back now. Yeah, no, their relationship's super fucked up.
Yeah, but like at the same time, we discover that the different levels of what's going on psychologically with the narrator of our film. And then we see even how, like, in this messed up, abusive relationship, there being these moments of genuine connection or care. Like, and so it makes it interesting. It's not just one-sided, but it's enough to make you know that at least Edward's character, like, I mean, obviously, Marla is messed up in some of her own ways as well. And so there's some of that connection of seeing each other and, you know, hitting each other's buttons, a lot of highs and a lot of lows. So I'm not saying they're meant for each other. And if only he didn't have that other personality, everything would be A-okay.
Well, no, but like, but Marla, she comes off in the beginning as having all of these negative qualities to her. And yeah, she does have them, but she's also like trying to work through them on her own. And she becomes a victim of circumstance. Like, I'm really into this guy and he's a fucking psychopath, but I can't get away from this feeling that I have for him, despite the toxicity of this relationship.
Yeah, it's a romp. It's a farce. It's a romantic thingamabob. And we're just chuckling throughout the whole thing. I mean, really, the only thing we're missing is that Marla didn't have, like, a best friend that, you know, a lady best friend she could confide in and that could joke around with.
Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, this is...
It's almost like they tried to stay away from tropes in this.
Yeah, it's so weird. That Fincher guy, he takes things in unexpected directions.
fucking no talent hack who just happens to make really good movies.
Or at least one.
At least one. I don't know. What else did he make? Hold on. I want to see that. Oh, he made Seven. He made Zodiac.
Never heard of him.
Anyhow.
He did that one TV show, Twin Peaks, right?
Did Fincher do Twin Peaks?
No. No. Oh. that was a joke. No, I'm sorry. But, like, yeah, he's directed a million things. But, yeah, everything from Seven to The Social Network and, you know, all that stuff. It's like he, even though those two may seem like very different movies, there's something about his style and the way he gets in the heads of the people that he's trying to show you. Like, the way he builds stories, even when you don't know what story is there. Like, so you could take something like Zodiac, based on a true story, or Gone Girl, based on a novel, and yet there's something similar in the style and the way the camera angles and how he chooses to frame people and conversations and heighten that sense of unease. It just, I don't know, I find it pretty captivating what he does with pretty much any material. Did you see the Mindhunter TV show?
No, I've been meaning to watch it, though.
Yeah, it's excellent. And another just further demonstration of what that style of making you uncomfortable, you know, revealing something that's based in or around true series, you know, I mean, it's based on a true story, but like the elements there, just getting sucked into the interactions with different like serial killers and all that they're interviewing, it's just every element of it is very captivating. And you see that again here with Fight Club, the way you're presented, at least for Tyler and the narrator Marla, like their characters, any combination of the two of the three of them, you know, working together, that there's just something incredibly connected in each way that they interact and communicate.
Yeah, there is. And it's one of the things that I really like that he does, too, is that he doesn't try to take the easy road and like have it be as simple as here's a good person, here's a bad person, and here's, you know, a victim, and here's a villain, and here's a, you know, an antagonist and a protagonist. Like he likes to intermingle those concepts and kind of leave you to A, draw your own conclusions about the characters, but also B, like show that people aren't as simple as one or the other. You can't just operate in extremes, even in works of fiction. So I liked that. And I mean, a lot of that too, it has to do with Chuck Palahniuk and how he wrote these characters, but
yeah,
the portrayal too, and the way that they were directed had a lot to do with it.
I'm interested, just again, like going back to what you're saying about this idea of the actual ages of all of the people in, you know, Tyler's army, because I feel like they have to be old enough to maintain these positions at these jobs, but maybe just emotionally, developmentally, they're still basically just a bunch of kids.
Well, I mean, if we look at the Fight Club membership, like you're looking at guys who are all roughly within, say, 15 or 20 years of each other. So we'll call it like 20 to 40 or 20 to 45. Mm-hmm. You know, these guys in the Fight Club. So that's probably right around the same ages that you get with the, you know, Project Mayhem, Tyler's Army guys, like Meatloaf probably being the oldest of them, and, you know, the kid on the porch being the youngest. Yeah, that first kid who shows up.
Yeah. We all know who he is. He has one of those faces.
Yep. Actually, this time around, my the first time I looked at him, I went, "Wait, is that Badger from Breaking Bad?" And like, no, that can't be him. No, it wasn't. It was that Who other guy.
You don't have it fired up on the internet?
Well, nobody has names, so it's not like I can just go, "Oh yeah, it's him, that guy."
Got Got that guy. He's too young.
Got Guy Dudington.
Dear Google, who in Fight Club is the guy who was on the porch that was too young? I wonder if I typed all that out. Yeah.
Bop, boop. I don't know. Please ask again later.
I'm going to actually type it out exactly as a verbatim for what I just said. Dear Google, who was the guy? We'll see how artificial intelligence has come along.
I'll tell you, artificial intelligence is loud.
Oh, you know what? They messed up. They gave me an answer, and it's not the right answer. When I said, Dear Google, who is the guy that was too young on the porch in Fight Club? The answer they gave me was Angel Face.
But that's not right, because that's Jared Leto.
Yeah, so maybe they're confusing it with the book and the movie yet. I'm very disappointed in artificial intelligence now, so.
Pretty lame.
I mean, how are we supposed to know things if we don't know things, if we can't use the internet to fill in all the gaps in our knowledge? It's very disturbing.
It's what the internet is for, and I'm actually very, very disappointed. Anyhow.
Yeah, I guess we can not obsess over that for an hour or two.
Yeah, I mean, there's more to the show than just obsessing over a single character who has like five lines in the whole movie. And if you've been on the internet, speaking of, and you've looked up anything about Fight Club and sort of the imagery and the messaging and who sort of has taken this as like a gospel almost, you'd run across names like incels and men's rights activists and stuff like that. And I'm not going to say that that their interpretation of the movie is right or wrong, but what do you think the right message is to take away from Fight Club?
I mean, I'm pretty comfortable leaning on this whole idea again about it just being, it's about a relationship and about someone trying to come to terms with the very concept of maturing emotionally and what that means in the context of having all sorts of defensive mechanisms wrapped up and warped by psychological ailments that are causing problems. And so all of the framework of the, you know, breaking free from corporate America and the, like, there's so much contradictory information, which is just, that's how a young person's mind would work. Like, this whole idea that, you know, stop letting corporations tell you what to do, but listen to me tell you what to do by me giving you rules, and you're going to rebel and be an anarchist that follows rules. Like, it's just a circle of, there's no endorsement of this as a beautiful way of life and everyone should embrace this and learn from it. It's just it's sarcastic, and it's like telling on itself, and it's saying, this doesn't make sense and I'll tell you why. But isn't it kind of cool, but also horrible?
Well, yeah, and like I think that sort of corollary between this and like the rejection of capitalism and the rejection of communism, and how they're sort of two parts of the same whole, like that I think is a very powerful message that sort of stands throughout, and like, you know, the don't let the things that you own you, or whatever it is that Tyler had said, like material possessions are the devil or whatever. I think you're right, especially as I get older and I look at the movie from my, you know, age of closing in on 40 in the next couple of years. Like, it's about allowing yourself to mature by being your true self and like being true to who you are, and not sort of bucking expectations instead of going by what would be the status quo, or what you think other people expect of you, or how you think people interpret, you know, what it means to be successful. Like, do it on your own terms, and do it sort of as you think the best for you is. Like, don't let someone else dictate it.
Except that the irony being that the entire premise of the movie is the person telling you that you should be true to yourself is in fact a fractured person within and unto himself who is not being true to himself, where everything is based on a lie and everything he's doing is fracturing him further until he finally starts to figure out how he can break that part of his life off. And so it's like there's still like all of these actions, everything happening, it becomes a more and more desperate plea to split personalities further apart and more dynamically away from each other instead of embracing who you are and taking action to just get away from stuff. And like it's framed in a way that on the surface has a certain amount of sense, and you can go, yeah, like I am not Jack's reclining sofa or whatever, but you know, whatever you, the things that you can see like that, like they're legit, but they're all like advertising slogans. They're all like surfacey things that make an impact on the minds of all of these people who are all a part of this group and buy into it deeper than anything else. And it's like, it is such a commentary even now, 20 some years after the fact, that like this is what we see all around us every day. And then we also see people saying, wake up, you know, you gotta, you know, stop listening to the media, stop listening to people telling you what's out there. And it's like, yeah, you're trying to take the role of the person, you're saying don't listen to anybody, but then you're also saying listen to me tell you don't listen to anyone. And it's like the cyclical thing of who do you trust? How do you develop? How do you mature? How do you develop relationships? There's so many layers of what's going on there. But I think that this is, you know, on that level, all those aspects in this movie are things that are you're supposed to, not supposed to, but I feel like I came away just kind of almost laughing, saying, yeah, it's all pointless. Maybe Marla has this, you know, the most realistic and healthy viewpoint by just saying, yeah, nothing matters anyway, we're all just going to die at some point. And that as a person working for an insurance company who's always, you know, adding numbers into an equation, and he keeps saying, you know, at some point, you know, the life expectancy of a person is going to
become zero. Yeah,
yeah. And like that, maybe that is the biggest lesson that I like, I get like the whole whatever choice you make, whatever you do, understand that you don't have infinite time, you know, your time's limited, so what are you going to do with it? That I feel is maybe my takeaway and the message I feel strongest.
Well, and I'm not going to say that you're wrong, but at the very end he does break that cycle. He does break through that you know, the back and forth of the two personalities, and he figures out how to beat Tyler. And
yeah,
says,
does he?
Well, it depends on like how much you buy into the graphic novels that happened afterward. But the in this film, in this self-contained universe of Fight Club, yeah, where we have a beginning and an end, he does eventually break through that barrier and say, okay, well, I'm done being me, the narrator, but I'm also done being Tyler, and I'm now going to be this new person who is independent of those two, and I'm gonna stop being a dick to Marla. Probably gonna put an end to this whole Project Mayhem thing. And like that's really my takeaway as far as sort of the in your face narrative is like, okay, I'm now finally taking this step to say, okay, I can be a healthy ish person and move forward rather than continuing through this toxic hell that I've put myself and my girlfriend through.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that's what I got there.
Well, I think I think that we've once again demonstrated that we're able to take a popular movie and unveil that it's really just a sad, depressing statement about life, and that's all we can ever hope for. Or something.
Yeah. I mean, you're not wrong.
I guess I could be going a bit far because it's not like there's anything going on in our world or universe at this time that would make life all seem like one grand joke. There's no reason to feel bad. Let's feel happy instead. Let's talk about happy things like puppies.
Yeah. Well, there's no puppies in this movie. I wish that there were, because that'd be pretty, pretty amazing.
Well, I do have to say that watching this movie, like I said in the opening, a friend of mine had brought up the movie as a topic and asked, have we considered doing it? And that got us just talking a bit about the movie. And we had, he and I, Tad and I, had chatted a little bit about if we were going to try to reboot or recast the movie, who would play some of the key parts in this movie? And I had some thoughts then, but now rewatching it again now, I feel a little less certain than I did back then. I know I have one or two picks that I just think would be perfect, but I know I'm kind of springing this on you. If you want to, you know, I don't know if you have any people in mind for some of the main parts. Right now, my main biggest thing, I'm just thinking of narrator, Tyler, and Marla as the three that I'm most invested in and trying to cast or imagine. And so, I don't know, do you have any thoughts on that? You're the one who's always trying to get Hollywood on the phone.
Yeah, I think I could come up with some good players. If we were, you're talking about rebooting this movie, right? With like current younger actors, like sort of the age that these actors were, but now?
No, I'm talking about rebooting the movie.
Oh,
however,
okay, yeah.
You see fit. You can make Morgan Freeman and Jack Nicholson be like the main two characters. Like
they did that.
I don't know if that would work, but like
they did that movie. It could,
yeah, exactly. And I definitely have never watched it 100 times a day. No. It could be any direction you want. With Hollywood being the way Hollywood is, they may be. You could probably sell it if you have some younger faces, some diverse faces, things like that.
Sure.
But whatever you think, who could capture the tone of these characters?
Well, who do you feel the strongest about? I guess would be my first question to you.
Because I was so focused on Marla, the pick that I have for Marla, I feel very strong about, and I think she could absolutely nail the dynamics and be a real shining point.
Okay.
And that person is Zendaya.
Ooh, okay.
I think that she has a really great range and can play kind of dark, mysterious, aloof in a way, but also just be really, you know, toe that line between being kind of dark and depressed, but also emotionally trying to break through to someone. And so, yeah, I definitely think she'd be my pick.
I like that. I like her as a pick for Marla. I think that that's a strong one. I don't know that this actor would have the particular range or the chops that a Zendaya would have, but I think from a looks perspective, I think you could go with like a Ruby Rose and get a good Marla look. You'd probably have to coach her through acting the entire thing, because as cool and or I guess just as cool as Ruby Rose comes off, I kind of see her a little one-dimensionally as an actor.
I'm not coaching any actors. I'm gonna have actors that can already act.
Maybe like
that's asking a lot.
Like an Emma Watson, maybe she could probably pull off that role.
I have a hard time. Like, maybe it's because I'm already sold on my own pick. And I know it's kind of pigeonholing the casting a bit to go, like, that young. You know, because I don't want it to be creepy where you have someone who's, like, 33 is the, you know, the male lead. And then the female lead is, you know, 23 or however old she is. I don't know. But, like, that could be, you know, you want to have a younger...
Emma Watson's, like, 30.
No, I meant Zendaya.
Oh, Zendaya. Yeah. Yeah, but, I mean, that part of it can be rough, but like you can work around that.
All right. Well, we both agree that I have the best pick for Marla, so let's move on. Who would you think for the narrator?
Oh, the narrator. See, I could go with like an Ezra Miller. I think that he sort of has a good mixture of you know, semi-serious but also kind of funny. Or maybe like a Joe Keery, I think, would probably do okay. Joe Keery, you would know as Steve Harrington. Oh, I'm saying for our audience. Steve Harrington from Stranger Things. I think that he would do all right in that role.
It could be interesting. I don't, I'm not sure about his range, but I wouldn't necessarily say he can't do it either. I just don't know. Like, it could be a really great pick, like, out of nowhere. And, like, yeah, I kind of had a hard time with this because the pick I had is someone who I know has the right temperament and the right acting and could really pull it off. But as my friend Tad pointed out, he is, like, very small and scrawny, and, like, that might be hard to buy him as being like the center of this fighting ring where fighting's all they do, and like that might be hard. Not saying you can't be a great fighter if you're tiny, but have you seen that movie, not movie, a TV series on Netflix called The End of the Fucking World?
Oh yeah, I think I've seen a couple of the episodes. I haven't watched the whole thing, but I think I know who you're talking about.
But yeah, Alex Lothar is the main guy in that, and I just am so impressed with like how he's able to act a role like in that series, and how that could translate well to this narrator role, being very a combination of awkward, but with some elements of like rage and detachment, and all of these things are all like feeding in behind his eyes. And it's like that could really work well in this role.
And you know, he does have that element, because if you've watched his episode of Black Mirror, mm-hmm. he can definitely bring that emotion and that intensity to the role.
Yeah.
So I can see that for sure.
So I'm not sure about the physicality, but maybe that's why you get these trainers to, you know, do horrible things to your body. To
sure. I mean, look what they did with Chris Pratt between, you know, being this chubby guy on Parks and Rec and turning him into Star-Lord. So,
or maybe they'll just do CGI.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Do you have any... you already kind of said this, so go ahead.
So, yeah. Who did you think of for Tyler?
Tom Holland.
Mm.
I think he's got it in him. I think he does. I think he hasn't had a chance in like major roles. He's kind of a bit more comic relief, a bit more
doofy. He's doofy. Like
I think he could be cool. I think it could happen. I think he could cross that line and become the cool and edgy. I don't know. Like, it's just an instinct. I don't know. Who do you think?
See, I had Michael B. Jordan for this.
That's, I mean, that like
Michael
only
B. Jordan
problem...
in his Killmonger role. Like, I think that he's the right combination of intense and violent and funny.
I mean, I think he would be great. I think that there would be, like, as an actor, as someone who could fill that role. And, like, I think if we were doing a straight-up recast remake of the ages of the people in the movie and all, but that then, like I said, that kind of hits that thing where you have someone who's, like, in their, you know, mid-30s with someone who's, like, barely, you know, 21 or 22 or something, and, like, and then that becomes a little bit weird and awkward. Like, and so that's the only thing that doesn't work for me, which, again, we can mess with these castings, but if we're taking it piece by piece, then yeah, I think that he could be a good fit as well.
Did you have any other characters in mind to recast? Because I could probably think of a couple others.
I mean, I was just playing around with you know, like with Bob and Angel Face and all. And
oh, who did you have for Angel Face?
Well, this was another problem with someone who I don't know if they're going to quite have the physical role, but as far as just being like someone who could come across as a presence of their main role is to be something beautiful that is destroyed, you know, by like the narrator. I was saying, thinking maybe Timothy Chalamet.
Okay. Timothy Chalamet is a good choice there. I do think he is sort of like your, Alex Lothar pick, sort of a little scrawny, a little waifish, maybe something more along the lines of like, a Robbie Amell, I think would be a good pick for that role, because he's got he's got the pretty boy face, but he's also like he's actually got like some physicality to him. Robbie Amell, if you don't know, he's on he has a series on Amazon called Upload, where he dies and is uploaded into this sort of virtual world. He's also had limited runs on The Flash on the CW. I think he's a serviceable enough actor, and I think that he would do fairly well.
It's funny you mention him, because right before I watched Fight Club, I watched Code 8 on Netflix, which had both Robbie and Stephen Amell brothers working together. I'd give that movie maybe a 5.9 out of 10.
You're being generous, it looks like, but I would probably watch it anyway.
Like, 5.9 might be a bit high. Maybe a flat 5, because it wasn't horrible. It just wasn't good. At any rate, getting off track, and we don't like to do that on this podcast. Possibly. I don't know. I guess this is one of those times when we're going to have to reach out and see if we can have some of our listeners help guide us in the right direction for recasting Fight Club. Real quick for Bob, and this was just because this amused me. Mm-hmm. My pick for Bob would be Taylor Lautner.
Oh, that's fantastic. Oh, man. God, for Bob, fucking Taylor Lautner. Oh, I know. So if you've ever watched, there's a show on Hulu called Letterkenny. There's an actor, his name's K. Trevor Wilson. Look him up. He could totally play Bob. He's got the build of Bob, and you could put some prosthetic boobs on him, and he would definitely be able to fit into that role. And he's so funny. Like, if you ever watch his stand-up, he's fucking great. We could sing the praises of David Fincher all day long, but there's something about the visuals of this movie, I think, that really just they stand out to me. Like, you get these sort of, some colors are more intense and some are more subdued, and you get like this great camera work and this like just really, really strong storytelling via the camera.
Yeah, I think this movie is one of the best examples. And again, I'm trying to think, was this 99? Was that when it came out? I know you've said it, but...
Yes, this is 99.
So this is about the real close to the same time frame as The Matrix and all, and just thinking about different stylizations, because there were some aspects of this that I felt had like a coolness, like a Matrix coolness, even though it's not at all that type of movie. But some of the faraway framing of shots and what they did, but something that was incorporated so well in this were just the visual effects, like when you have narrator in his apartment and they're labeling all the various IKEA furniture.
Yes.
He's walking around the apartment, and then they do a lot of really great scene and or in scene transitions, like the opening credits where you're following through the DNA of the body all the way into the barrel of the gun that's in his mouth, or scenes where they're like talking about, someone could have turned off the pilot light and stuff, and then the camera tracks through the apartment and then goes behind the stove. So that transition from like what could be a real shot to CGI to take you inside of different things, it's like it has such a cool effect for the storytelling. You don't have to break the scene in any way. You can continue forward with these impossible shots. And all those elements, I think, really lent itself to the coolness and the visual storytelling. And I also have to say, as a person who has grown up a bit, that I think living where they lived in that particular house, not the apartment, but the house where Tyler
on Paper Street,
were, yeah, that might be like the worst nightmare I've ever had in my life. And I'm like, oh my God, like I don't care what I'm going through in life. I'm not living there. Like, no. It was horrible. And like, and so I think there's that, if I was, back, a young kid and teen or in my 20s or something, like I might be like, yeah, I don't care. I'll live in a dirty basement. Everything's cool. But now I'm like, no, I don't think so.
So I mean, with regard to the visual effects and the CGI and everything, that was really hard to do back then. Like from like 1990 to 2010, you had this this era of shitty CGI. Like, there were CGI effects in movies that were just completely inexcusable by any standard. And, like, if you look at it today, you go, oh, God, that's fucking awful. They did exceptionally well, given the technology of the day. They, especially those shots of, like, in the apartment, like, that pullback shot from, like, under the fridge or from under the, the stove or whatever. Absolutely well done. With regard to the house, having been a homeowner, there's no fucking way I would buy that house and raise it to the fucking ground and rebuild. Like, there's no way in hell that I would be living in that house with the leaks and the basement that's flooded and the fucking fuse box. No, absolutely not. I'm not doing it. There's no way. I'd probably get fucking MRSA living in there. Like, no, absolutely not.
Yeah, I mean, so I think really, you know, the way I think about this movie, I've changed my mind completely on the whole reboot angle. I think what we really need to do is more of a reboot slash sequel and turn this into like a home improvement kind of romantic comedy Hallmark type movie called Fight Club 2 in the house.
Oh, and we get Tim Allen.
Oh, God, I that disgusts me more than the house, maybe. I can't do that. Yeah, we'll have to workshop this, but I think, yeah, I think there's some potential here. Yeah, that's pretty exciting. That's, I mean, aside from, I think we have a couple of really, really strong candidates to get some audience reaction on. We could either go with just an overall recast reboot, you know, helping people find the right actors, or we can get people to volunteer to help us. Oh, we can get the Property Brothers. Oh, and they could play both.
Oh, Taylor. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Tyler and...
and the narrator. Okay. Yeah, that's it. We did it. We solved the movie. Great job.
Okay.
All right. That's
fixed it. All right.
That's it then. That's our show.
Quick. Let's get out of here.
Thank you guys so much for listening to us each and every week as we distill another favorite from our past. You can catch new episodes every Monday. If you'd like to comment on who you would recast in this movie, John's going to tell you right now how to get that information to us.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to make it public and have a nice lively discourse, just check out our Facebook page. Get some back and forth going on there. If you don't like that scene, just email us at thememorydistillery@gmail.com. Or, you know, you can always tweet us at TMDpod, or that's our Instagram handle as well. All that good stuff going on. The point is, it's so much fun when you guys start jumping in, like in this last week, and we just kind of go back and forth and share a lot of stuff. Let's keep doing that. One other thing I do want to mention is... You know what that was?
Yep, I sure do. But why don't you tell the audience what it was? Because I'm still in that shock.
Yeah, because I understand that you would just be wondering, how exactly did you pull off that amazing impersonation of the song opening up in the end credits of Fight Club?
Yeah, exactly. How did you do that?
Did you have that same reaction?
That was my exact reaction. You put it into perfect words.
Well, the Pixies were too busy writing Where's My Mind to come up with something we could use for our podcast, so we got something better?
I'd say better.
Or on par, perfect for us, better for us. And that's Destroying the Evidence, a song written by Semaphore. So that flawless, maybe beautiful transition to talking about music comes to you from me to you. Merry Christmas. Oh, yeah. And thanks for listening. I'm John Deck.
And I am Anthony Verneri. And this has been the Memory Distillery.
No, just run away. We nailed it. Let's get out of here.
Perfect. Got it in one.